Hi, everyone. So thank you for coming out to our KCSB news event of this year on natural disasters, environmental racism. I'm KCSB's external news director, Dorothy Tang, and this is my internal news director, Anita Carraher. And we are live on KCSB FM 91.9 in Santa Barbara during our annual fund drive. So if any point you'd like to donate, our phone line is 805-893-2424. That's 805-893-2424. The focus of this panel is to look at the implications of unnatural disasters on marginalized communities due to non-inclusive and outdated policies. The general agenda for tonight is to get an understanding of what environmental racism and injustice looks like and case studies and incidences of environmental racism, as well as the collaborative efforts in moving forward and envisioning how policymakers and government responses can incorporate marginalized communities. To those in the audience, we'll be ending the panel with a Q&A session, so be sure to keep your questions in mind for the end. So while we're hosting this panel, it's especially important and pertinent considering the recent disasters and environmental issues in our community, such as the Thomas Fire, Hill and Woolsey fires, Oxnard Power Plant, Cat Canyon proposals, and more.
So to discuss these issues, KCSB News has pulled together a group of panelists from a wide range of expertise, starting with UCSB student Cynthia Torres. She's a fourth-year UCSB undergraduate student who is pursuing a major in environmental studies and a minor in chemistry. They currently serve as environmental justice chair under UCSB's Environmental Affairs Board, EAB. They're also the founder of UCSB's Student for Environmental Justice, which is now known as Environmental Justice Alliance.
Hello, thank you for having me.
We also brought in organizers Lucas Zucker from CAUSE and Genevieve Flores-Haro from MyCop. Lucas Zucker is the Policy and Communications Director for CAUSE, which is the Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy, a nonprofit community organization that works to advance social, economic, and environmental justice in the Central Coast of California. Lucas joined CAUSE in 2012 as a youth organizer and researcher. At CAUSE, he's worked on community organizing campaigns and policy advocacy around voting rights, healthy food access, immigrant rights, affordable housing, prison sentencing reform, and workers' rights, just to name a few. Outside of CAUSE, Lucas also serves on the board of the National Nonprofit Partnership for Working Families.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And Genevieve serves as the Associate Director for the Mixteco Indigenous Community Organizing Project, or MICOP, a nonprofit serving Ventura County's Indigenous immigrant community. As Associate Director, she oversees the organization's policy priorities, special events, and communications, as well as supervises programs specific to health access and advocacy, mental health, and domestic violence. In 2018, she was awarded a Woman of the Year Award by State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson and Assemblymember Monique Lamone for her work during the Thomas Fire, which included advocacy around Spanish interpretation for emergency notifications, distribution of N95 masks to farm workers, and founding of the 805 Undocu Fund.
Buenas tardes. Really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
In line with our panel, we've also invited a few people from academia, a couple faces that you might know around here on campus, starting with Professor David Pello. He's the Delson and Department Chair of Environmental Studies and Director of the Global Environment Justice Project here at UCSB. He teaches courses on race, class, gender, and environmental conflict, sustainability, and social change movements that confront our socio-environmental crisis and social inequality. He has volunteered for and served on the board of directors of several community-based national and international organizations that are dedicated to improving the living and working environments for people of color, immigrants, indigenous peoples, and working class communities. These include the Global Action Research Center, the Santa Clara Center for Occupational Safety and Health, Greenpeace USA, and International Rivers. His research has covered environmental injustices nationwide, from landfills in Chicago to occupational hazards in California's Silicon Valley.
Thanks for having me here.
Another face you might recognize is Leah Stokes, who's an assistant professor in UCSB's Political Science Department, affiliated with both the Environmental Studies Department and the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management. Her research examines public policy, public opinion, and political behavior with a focus on energy and the environment. Leah's current book project studies interest groups' role in changing U.S. states' energy policy with a focus on policy feedback theory, renewable portfolio standards, and net metering laws. Other ongoing projects include examining protests against energy infrastructure, environmentalist electoral participation, violence against environmental activists, and effective water conservation policy in California. Prior to academia, Leah worked at the Parliament of Canada and Resources for the Future.
Great, thanks so much for having me here tonight.
And lastly, we have Doss Williams. Supervisor Doss Williams was elected to represent the 1st District of Santa Barbara County in June 2016 and has previously represented the area, along with over half of Santa Barbara County and a quarter of Ventura County in the California State Assembly from 2010 to 2016. His work included advocating for renewable energy and the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, coastal preservation, and emergency preparedness. He has also authored legislation to increase the renewable energy goal to 50% by 2030 and supported funding for water recycling and conservation efforts.
Thank you for having me.
We'd like to start the panel off by being able to contextualize kind of why we're all here today. It's a term familiar with many of us on the panel, but not necessarily us in the audience. So could we just kind of discuss about what environmental racism is and what it looks like, you know, relative to your expertise?
Well, this is Doss Williams. I'll jump in because we're all looking at each other going, oh, God, who wants to answer that first? My passion in regards to this subject matter centers around a real global issue. And usually we don't always think of this as an environmental racism issue, but I do, and that is climate change. About 200 odd million people live in areas that are expected to be underwater in the next 50 to 100 years, and those folks are disproportionately the most poverty-stricken folks in the globe, especially when you're talking about Asia. And, you know, I think it's an issue that's partially exacerbated because people in our own movement, that is the environmental movement, have not cut this as a humanitarian issue. They've cut it as an issue affecting ecologies, affecting systems, but what it really is an issue that will affect people and how swift we respond to climate change and how effectively is, to me, mainly a question of how many people do we allow to be displaced refugees, especially from Asia. How many people, and in my view, in the history of humankind, when you displace millions of people, you cause a whole lot of death, a whole lot of disease, a whole lot of sex slavery. The most comparable event is the end of World War II, where after the war was over, millions of people were forcibly removed and millions died. And I think that is something that disproportionately will affect the poorest on the globe.
If I could follow up, this is David Pello. I would say the way, and first of all, I would say that people can define environmental racism and its opposite, environmental justice, in various ways that make sense for them in their particular contexts, cultural context, and given their histories. But the way I generally would define it, I would definitely agree with Doss Williams. Environmental racism for me is the intersection of racism and environmental harm. It's an example of the broader issue of environmental injustice. And this occurs whenever we find socially marginalized populations anywhere on planet Earth who are also facing disproportionate environmental harm. Pollution, climate change risks, other public health risks that are often associated with corporate, with industrial, with state-based developmental practices and policies that result in extraordinary levels of asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, skyrocketing rates of cancer and various other health problems, anxieties, mental health issues, cultural disintegration, and literally the tearing apart of people's communities. Climate change, for example, is no longer an abstract issue. We have, at least one community in the continental United States, the indigenous community of the Île de Jean Charles, who is actually having to vacate, literally being displaced from their community. I could point to many more historically, but in recent times, we now have this example where people are literally being forced to move from their territories, from their communities, not because of quote-unquote natural disasters, but as the framing of this panel really encapsulates, because of unnatural disasters, because of policies, because of decisions made by governments, by corporations, by human beings that have placed particular populations who are already vulnerable in situations of greater vulnerability. That is racism because it is rooted in the ideology, the ideas, the discourses, the cultural practices that elevate certain groups above others, that value certain groups more than others, and that make it perfectly legitimate in the minds of certain people to perpetrate ecocide and genocide against other folks.
I'll add real quick, just to take this from the big picture global level down to the local level, and this is Lucas, by the way, here in our community. When you look at this region of Ventura and Santa Barbara counties, and you look at where all of the oil fields are located, where all of the power plants, oil refineries are located, where there's the most heavily industrialized agriculture using really high levels of fumigant toxic pesticides, it is virtually all our majority community of color areas, Oxnard, Santa Maria, Santa Paula, the west side of Ventura. And here locally, there's certainly been an environmental justice movement, particularly in the community of Oxnard, which is where kind of a lot of the heavy industry for our region is concentrated, and is a community that's 85% people of color, and has been fighting some of those polluting facilities for many years. Had a huge victory after a years-long fight against the Puente power plant. Oxnard has all the region's major power plants, hundreds of people coming out to public hearings to speak out against this, and defeated the largest operator power plants in the United States, NRG. Really, really incredible victory for environmental justice. And just want to talk about how locally we're working on environmental justice here.
So I have a question for Cynthia, actually. As a student of environmental studies here at UCSB, where does environmental justice, environmental racism, kind of situate itself into the context of the larger understanding of environmental studies?
This is Cynthia, as you stated. So basically, the reason why I'm on this panel is because, as you stated in my bio, I created an organization called Students for Environmental Justice. And what we have found is that majority of the members who come into those organizations who are interested in environmental justice aren't necessarily environmental studies students. But overall, we all feel like the overarching stereotype of white environmentalism and stereotypical environmentalism, which is non-inclusive and doesn't look at how environmental problems affect marginalized communities, that kind of haunts us in our environmental work, where we feel no matter, even though we are becoming more diverse as a student population, we still feel that when people hear we're environmental studies students, they stereotypically put us in this box. But that's not the case. And the members in this organization are often POC. And so we've bonded over environmental injustices from our local community. And if you look at who's talking about environmental injustices, it's always a student of color. And so that's why in our mission statement, we have that we prioritize queer and trans people of color and people of color in general. And that's our main focus because of these past instances and personal instances of environmental racism from our own community back home.
So as this panel title has stated, we're really looking at environmental racism in the context of disasters. But before we kind of get into that, could we kind of discuss more about systemic problems of environmental racism and what that looks like? To each of you.
Well, I'll talk about it from a market perspective. This is Doss Williams, your county supervisor. I mean, our system does rely on the market, and in a market, it is going to penalize people that are occupying cheaper housing. One of the worst examples of environmental racism that's affecting the most kids of color in the state is proximity to the freeway of where you live. Right? The lower lifespan, the higher incidences of respiratory problems are well documented the closer that you live to a freeway. And here I'm, Santa Barbara is not immune to that. I mean, we've got the same bad air quality close to here. And you, as a father of two little daughters, one's a three-year-old and one's a six-month-old, I feel really guilty that the only house that your elected supervisor could afford is like a stone's throw off the freeway, is like the second house next to the freeway. And that is something that is even worse when you go into denser communities of color and larger freeway systems in more urbanized communities, and the health effects are even worse.
I'll hop on this one. This is Genevieve. The community that we work with at MICOP are indigenous migrants from southern Mexico, and many work in farm work. Many are farm workers picking our crops, picking in the $2 billion ag industry for Ventura County. And so when you think about environmental racism, our folks are getting hit from all angles. They're getting hit from their actual day-to-day work when they're in the fields, whether it's pesticide exposure, whether it's dust, whether it's any of those factors that are affecting their health, to where they live at home, where it's multiple families in one home, high-density areas that are conveniently located next to these power plants, Superfund, radioactive sites. The average age, life expectancy for a migrant farm worker is 49. And you think about what it is for everyone else who's not doing that work, your 70s, your 80s. That for me is the environment taking an impact on these folks who are just here, for more opportunity to provide for their families.
This is Leah Stokes. I'll add, I was watching Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on Instagram Live yesterday, of all things, and she's fantastic, and she's doing a really wonderful job highlighting the fact that climate change is happening now and that it is disproportionately affecting people of color in the United States. For example, Puerto Rico is still in an emergency state in many, many parts of that area, and Puerto Rico doesn't have voting rights in this country. President Trump has done little to nothing to help those people who are American citizens. And so, we don't really have to think about climate change happening in the future. Climate change is happening now, and it is going to disproportionately affect poor people and people of color. There was a recent study that came out a few weeks ago, and it showed by David Victor, who's a professor at UC San Diego, and some colleagues, and it showed that the southern parts of the United States is actually extremely vulnerable to climate change. And of course, this is historically a very highly populated black area in the United States. And of course, people who, as we saw in Louisiana, for example, with Hurricane Katrina, people who live in certain areas tend to be people of color, and they tend to be much more environmentally at risk places. So we don't really have to think about these problems happening in the future. We can just look at Flint and look at lead in the water and realize that we have massive environmental disparities and massive impacts from climate change already happening in the United States.
I'll just, once an organizer, always an organizer, I'll talk about two issues going on locally that are issues of environmental justice. The first is here in Santa Barbara County in the Cat Canyon oil field redevelopment. In that area, the Santa Maria Valley, it's, really low income, majority, 75-80% people of color area, heavily dependent on groundwater for drinking water and also the agriculture jobs that a lot of folks depend on. And a lot of this new oil drilling, there's a proposal to drill 750 new wells outside of Santa Maria. This is an oil field where there's been oil drilling there for many years. They've gotten all the good, easy oil, and they want to drill now through the groundwater aquifers down, to get that dirty crude down below. And that puts the whole community's drinking water at risk in a way that other communities are not exposed to. And obviously, this is just bad for everyone, but certainly is a risk, particularly to folks in a way that I think would not be acceptable to have that level of oil drilling outside of the city of Santa Barbara, right? And yet here we are outside of Santa Maria. Similarly, we've done a lot of work for many years in Oxnard around environmental justice issues and industrial pollution. The port of Hueneme, ports everywhere are some of the largest contributors to air pollution. You've got big boats with big engines coming into the port, stuff being loaded out and onto diesel trucks that drive through the community and emit a lot of pollution. And ports everywhere because of globalization are expanding, right? There's more global trade, and ports are needing to eat up a bigger footprint and move more stuff. And so the Port of Wainimi is proposing to expand along the coast of South Oxnard, not only really blocking off the Oxnard from its coast because of all that kind of just industrial land uses creating kind of a wall between the community and the ocean, but running more and more diesel trucks through some of the poorest and most heavily people of color and immigrant neighborhoods in the Central Coast. And so there are folks organizing on both of these issues. They're great ways to get involved in environmental justice locally.
This is David Pello. I'd like to also weigh in on this question of racism and inequality on a systemic level. And this is really important. I don't think that scholars like myself have done a terribly good job of doing this. And so let me take a stab at this. Inequality is at the core. When people ask me what is the greatest environmental threat to planet Earth, my response is social inequality. My response is the threat to democracy. My response is the erosion of social equity across the planet. Flip that around and you find that democracy and social equality in empirical study after empirical study turns out to be very good for the environment. Flip that around, the obverse is true, that social inequality is actually bad for the environment. Think of any dictator, any strongman leader, any authoritarian person leading a government, from Bolsonaro to Erdogan to Trump to Kim Jong-un, etc. These folks view nature, view non-human nature, view environmental protection as absolutely the bottom of the barrel concern. It's not a concern for them. In fact, it's the opposite. They view the defiling, the despoiling of nature, of our life support systems as absolutely crucial to maintaining their political power and their cults of personality. So democracy is actually good for the environment. Let me drill down a little further. Naomi Klein reminds us that this idea that inequality is at the core really goes to the history of the founding of the United States, to the history of climate change, anthropogenic climate change itself. The very first, among the very first economic supports and subsidies that made the Industrial Revolution possible, that made anthropogenic climate change that we have today what it is, came from the enslavement of human beings, the conquest of human beings, the onset of colonialization. So these things aren't diversity boxes to be checked. They are actually at the core, the center, the DNA of the problem. We have to begin with inequality. Another example, the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution is one of the things that we use to regulate trade, interstate trade, and international trade. Well, many communities of color have actually pushed back against the importation of hazardous waste into their communities across state lines, and legal battles have been waged and actually won by the opponents of environmental justice on the basis of the argument that to promote and secure and embrace and realize environmental justice would be unconstitutional because it would violate the right of communities, of white communities in one state, to poison communities of color in another state. It's in the Constitution. This is at the heart, the DNA of our culture, the legal system, and the economic system. So this is why tweaking, this is why reforms are not going to get us where we need to get in terms of environmental justice. It's at the core. Racism, classism, homophobia, transphobia, nativism, all of this, we have to address these issues. They aren't side issues. And I say this because just 2 weeks ago, a famous environmental historian told me to my face that justice and equality have nothing to do with environmental sustainability. I couldn't respond. I was so taken aback. This is a world famous environmental historian, but he couldn't be more wrong. The evidence is clear all around us.
Thank you so much for everyone's responses. We're going to take a quick break to do a pitch break. If you're just tuned in. KCSB News is presenting Unnatural Disasters, Environmental Racism, broadcasted live on KCSB FM 91.9 in Santa Barbara. We're hosting this panel during our on-air annual fund drive. If you're able, please call in and donate at 805-893-2424. That's 805-893-2424. We'll be moving on to our next discussion regarding explicit cases of environmental injustice in a local and national context. Like mentioned, moving on to our segment regarding case studies. As Lucas and other organizers have brought up about specific things that are happening in this area, like with Oxnard and such, and also Professor Pello has brought up about natural disasters understanding natural disasters as unnatural. They're typically understood to be an indiscriminate issue, but we know that these events become race and class issues depending on preferential response to affected communities. For example, in the case of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, the affluent areas of Condado was first to receive electricity over less affluent areas. During the Thomas fires, were there also considerable discrepancies in response and relief?
Well, this is Doss Williams. I think there is a couple good examples from the Thomas fire, which is maybe how both Santa Barbara and Ventura counties didn't have great translation services. We had translation services at the county of Santa Barbara, but they just weren't very good. I don't want to say good. They were just not very technical, couldn't translate the technical aspects of the issues very well. But I also just want to mention something that is maybe not an example of clear example of environmental racism, but it is an example of the scale of what we're up against. The 1-9 debris flows that followed the Thomas fire, killed, 23 people. And if you look at the individual bios of those folks, they were this is Montecito, second or third most wealthy zip code in the state, maybe fourth. And they were disproportionately clients of our county Medi-Cal system, right? They were disproportionately poor individuals. They were disproportionately, in comparison with the community at large, people of color and young. So, Montecito is a fairly older community, and they were disproportionately and a fairly white community, and a fairly affluent community, and they were disproportionately poor, brown, and young. And if that's the case in Montecito, what does that tell us about how environmental disasters, man-made disasters, will affect people across the globe?
This is Genevieve. So during the Thomas fire, one of the key pieces that we noticed was the lack of language access. Again, my organization, MyCop, our language access and language justice is a thread that binds all of the programs that we offer because our folks not only speak Spanish, but indigenous languages from Mexico, so Mixteco, Zapoteco, Otomi, Wave, Purépecha. And so for us, that first night of the fire when all of Ventura County was in pitch black because we lost our power that evening, half of Santa Barbara, trying to push that information, and all of it was in English. So then for us, we had the dual role of putting that information out in Spanish, in Mixteco, on our own radio station, via social media, and as well as trying to work with our county officials to flag it as an issue, like, hey, this is important, people aren't getting information. There was a boil water advisory for the city of Ventura, and the first two lines of the press release were in Spanish, and it said, make sure you have someone explain this good to you for a boil water advisory, knowing that water was contaminated. And that was during the Thomas fire. It took 10 days for county to finally put information in Spanish, and what they did is they moved the Google Translate box from the bottom of the page to the top of the page. So again, there was a lot to be said and done. We mentioned the Woolsey Hill fire, and so there was a lot of learning. And I do, in particular, want to thank County Supervisor John Zaragoza's office for being really willing to step up and step in. We hired a county public information officer to do that translation work in Spanish, and so when the Woolsey fire hit less than a year later, that was fixed, right? There's still many more things to learn and to grow in, but language access was definitely a big, big piece, especially, again, thinking about water advisory, boil water advisory notices. You're thinking about, air quality notices and who's really getting that information. It certainly wasn't the farm worker, working out in those really bad air quality.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about this, but I'll just talking about the kind of evacuation process in my own neighborhood, which is the west side of Ventura Avenue, was right there, you know, right at the kind of the perimeter. The firefighters were able to hold the line there, but that area was under mandatory evacuation for probably a week. And you know what I noticed in my neighborhood was that 80% of the people were still there. Right, this is a neighborhood where you couldn't drink the water during that time. You know, for a lot of that, the power was out, and people were still there. And I think it was a combination of both. With people not having access to the information about evacuations, but also people not necessarily being able to afford to evacuate, right? It's incredibly expensive to evacuate. And for a lot of people, they had to stay there and work. And I knew other people with kind of, you know, white-collar professional jobs, whatever, you know, they're just able to, like, leave for a month, right? And just, okay, stuff's bad, and, you know, in the 805, and I'm just going to, you know, peace out, get out of town, and, you know, go stay with family somewhere else or get a hotel. And for so many people, there really isn't that option. So I'll just leave it at that.
I'll just add, there's even something about the rebuilding process that shows a great cleavage in the community. You know, traditionally in our community, the aesthetic values have sort of trumped other things in land use questions, right? What's important to, you know, those in power is that it look good and it look in step with the character of our community. Well, that comes into conflict when you're trying to rebuild fast enough for middle class people to not run out of insurance money. Most insurance payouts are for 2 years for homeowners, and of course nothing if you're a renter. For people to be able to rebuild in 2 years, we had to draft an ordinance that would allow people to rebuild without an appeals process, because any appeals process would mean it would take 3, 4, 5 years to rebuild. And so for people in those neighborhoods that were hit harder, which are even, you know, which are some of the last middle-class neighborhoods left in Montecito, they understood and valued that we did that. But in a lot of the community, they're freaked out about having a process where there's no appeals process, because it, you know, offends their sense of the guardianship of aesthetic values. And I would maintain that if, as a body politic, if we don't prioritize safety and economic survivability up with aesthetic requirements, then we will hurt people farther down the economic ladder much more.
Thank you, everyone, for your answers. Definitely in that same vein, during the Thomas Hill and Woolsey fires, 805 UndocuFund had to work to assist local undocumented individuals and families because they were excluded from relief programs such as FEMA. What policy changes would be required to ensure undocumented people receive proper resources and services and are centered in these types of relief services?
This is Genevieve. I think one thing we've been discussing and fleshing out is realizing that in 805 UndocuFund, so the UndocuFund, really quickly, is a collaboration between three nonprofits that operate in the Central Coast. None of us are disaster relief organizations. This is not our bread and butter. It's something that was a need that we stepped in to fill. And that being said, you know, over the last year, we gave out almost $1.9 million to over 1,300 families. So it's a big endeavor, and it's certainly not sustainable for us. I'm not saying that we don't want to do it, but when you, again, we're not traditional disaster relief organizations. So for us, one policy change that we'd like to offer and flesh out is the thought of a statewide 805 or a statewide UndocuFund, because we modeled ours after Sonoma County, recognizing that these wildfires and these natural disasters are going to become our new normal. So having some sort of safety net statewide in place would be beneficial, so that could be activated wherever there's relief. Another thing along that same lines is even just statewide unemployment for undocumented individuals, because it's not just these fires, it's not just these floods, it's the rainy season, it's this cold. I don't know if folks have seen these videos on social media, but last week, you know, there were whole cilantro fields that were frozen. That's people's livelihoods. That's an impact for climate change on farm workers who, because that field is no longer good, no longer have a sustainable source of income. So also wanting to advocate for and figure out an unemployment for undocumented people that undocumented people are already paying into through their taxes.
Yeah, I'll add to that I think the experience around the state shows the need for real policy change. When we first started the 805 on Docu Fund, I gave a call to someone in Sonoma County who had just had the Tubbs fire there a few months ago. And I called her and I said, we heard all about your Undocu Fund on national news, and we want to start one here in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. And she honestly told me, I don't know if I'd do it. Like, it is crazy and it's a ton of work and you're probably not prepared for it and it's going to run you into the ground, right? And we went ahead and did it anyway because, you know, we don't listen to good advice.
Nope.
and it was... You know, after all of the work of just, you know, over 1,000 families and, you know, $2 million later, as we got to then when the Woolsey fire broke out and Hill fire broke out, we were still serving people on the wait list for the Thomas fire, right? Because we don't have the resources of FEMA. We don't have that level of infrastructure. And it took a long time. We got a lot of leftover money. A lot of our money came from leftover after the, you know, after kind of the homeowners had been served first, right? And then I saw fires like the Camp Fire, right, in Northern California and in places, really rural communities. You know, we're kind of a semi-rural community in a way, but really rural communities where there weren't immigrants' rights organizations there. There were not organizations like CAUSE or MyCop that could create something like the 805 on Docu Fund. And there was just nothing, right? There was just nothing in these places. And so to me, that's the need for something more systemic than this kind of patchwork of grassroots community organizations doing this. We need systemic policy change.
I think one of the best opportunities for that policy change, this Das Williams is in Medi-Cal. The Governor Newsom is proposing to incrementally increase the number of undocumented folks who are part of the Medi-Cal system right now. A child of an undocumented immigrant can get medical care, but an undocumented immigrant themselves does not, except in counties like Santa Barbara County, where we do that voluntarily for certain age groups already. But what Governor Newsom's proposing doing is providing Medi-Cal reimbursement for the first chunk, which would be, I think, 18 to 25. That would help in many parts of the state. It would only help us a little bit, but of course it would be easier to expand for other counties like ourselves that are already doing some of that to expand if some of the groups that we were already doing is reimbursed for. So this is a real big opportunity to provide a wider breadth of medical care.
I guess I just real quickly also add on the Undocu Fund. I think sometimes people are surprised at the scale needed with the 805 Undocu Fund. They're like, really, are there that many undocumented people who, you know, got hit by the mudslide in Montecito or something like that, right? And one, I think that's a lack of understanding of the way that we're all interconnected, right? I mean, you know, when wealthy homes in Montecito are destroyed, low-wage immigrant workers who clean those homes lose their jobs, right? And certainly all the just destruction of just, you know, rural trailers where farm workers live and things like that. But I think what it really demonstrates is the level of exposure to climate impacts that undocumented people have, right? I mean, we live in a system where there are millions of people who are made undocumented human beings by our immigration system and are basically, you know, occupy the rung of the workforce that is most exposed to natural disasters, outdoor workers, you know, people in the service and hospitality and domestic work industries, right? The most kind of vulnerable and marginalized workers are also these workers who our federal system has said, you are undocumented, we are going to exclude you from federal benefits, including disaster relief. Like, the Titanic's going down, we're not throwing you a lifeboat. Mm-hmm. So I think what it shows us is that there's a lot of misunderstanding of even who is impacted by disaster, mm-hmm. and the extent to which, even when you see homes in Malibu burning or you know, or whatever, you worry about, you know, sea level rise for beachfront, you know, multi-million-dollar mansions, right? It's actually, you know, those folks are often the ones who, they've got insurance, they, you know, they start their GoFundMe account, they, you know, right, they've got a benefit concert, they've got, you know, all these various structures. And not to say that people aren't, you know, negatively impacted, but that that often don't have anywhere near the safety net, right, and are often the people really, like, literally on the front lines of disaster around us.
This is Genevieve. You know, I think one thing in particular that was highlighted by the Wolseley Hill fire is just, like, the affluence and what money can truly buy you. You know, there was that report, and it sounds, like, ridiculous, but of, you know, the Kardashians, for example, part of their insurance policy was their own private firefighter detail. Mm-hmm. So their homes were saved. Right? So it's definitely a pay-to-play system in some cases, and that's definitely excluding of undocumented folks. And like Luke was saying, if you think about what the impacts are, you know, when we talk to folks who came in for the clinics, they're very much like, this isn't for me, I didn't lose a house, I, you know, my family's still here, but it's like, no, but you were still impacted, you lost work, right? You had to pay for childcare because schools were closed for a month under the Thomas fire, or you had to stay home and take care of your kids. Those are real impacts from fires and from what's happening with climate change that we don't really think about or consider as environmental.
Yeah, and I think this speaks to economists' inability to really wrap their heads around the true costs of climate change. You know, many of the things that my co-panelists are so eloquently describing in our own fairly wealthy community are things that would be pretty hard to stick in an economic model that we would say, oh, well, here were the economic costs of the Thomas fire or the Wolseley fire on Santa Barbara County or Ventura County. And so I really feel that when economists say, well, oh, you know, we've estimated climate change and it's going to cost this much GDP or that much GDP, and oh, we really can't afford to do the Green New Deal because it's really just going to be way too expensive, they don't really understand or truly estimate all the kinds of costs that people are describing of people losing their jobs who are already working in, you know, undocumented fields who aren't necessarily as easy to trace in the economic system, or about things that aren't even valued, like people staying home to take care of their children. All of these things are really hard to quantify in a standard economic model. And so I really feel that what people are saying here should push our thinking a lot in terms of how we understand climate impacts from an economic perspective, and that, you know, climate change is really going to cost us everything. I don't know if people saw, there was a really amazing new scientific paper that came out today which showed that if we get above, I believe, 4 degrees Celsius warming, and we've done 1 degree Celsius already, that we can have runaway climate change because of changes to high-level cloud formation, basically, and that that could lead to, I believe, an additional 8 degrees Celsius warming, which would literally make it impossible for people to walk around at the equator. Of course, fairly poor people tend to live at the equator. So I really think that we have for too long have let climate change be defined by economists who have a fairly narrow view of these issues, and that we should be more looking towards the people who are actually working with people in frontline communities to understand what climate change really looks like in practice and just how expensive and costly it's going to be.
You're listening to KCSB News. We're presenting the Unnatural Disasters and Environmental Racism panel, broadcasted live on KCSB FM 91.9 in Santa Barbara. We're hosting this panel during our on-air fund drive. You can call in and pledge at 805-893-2424. That's 805-893-2424. We'll be moving on to our discussion about how we can move forward to incorporate marginalized communities. And actually, going back to you, Leah, you've done research with your colleague, Matto Mildenberger, that revealed that political representatives on both the federal and state level frequently misestimate their constituents' opinions, usually considering them to be more conservative than they actually are. Could you explain how you guys came to that finding and what implications you see this as having in terms of climate change policy?
Yeah, so myself and two colleagues, Matto Mildenberger and Alex Hertel-Fernandez, did a study of chiefs of staff and legislative directors in Congress. And we've also done this at the state level with senior staffers as well as state politicians. So you might have been in our study, Das Williams, had you continued to be a member in the California legislature.
I would have probably skewed it differently.
So. Probably, yes. So basically what we found is that these very senior staff members in the political system have no clue what the people want on climate change. So if you've ever read an article about climate change, oftentimes there's quotes from the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, which shows that like 70% or 80% of people believe climate change is real, that they want action on this. There's this There's been downscaled maps that can do it, for example, at the county level of Santa Barbara County, and that's been on the cover of the New York Times 3 times. So this information is pretty easy to find out. All of you could go and Google it right now. And yet, the very senior people running our political system dramatically underestimate support for acting on climate change. And why do they do that? Well, we show that the places where they get it the most wrong tend to be offices where they're getting a lot of money from the fossil fuel industry, or they're meeting with the fossil fuel industry. These are groups like the American Petroleum Institute. That's the lobbying association for the fossil fuel industry. And so they really are not seeing what the public actually wants. And just to bring it down to the Santa Barbara context, you know, Santa Barbara went through a long-term planning process around bicycle infrastructure in this town. This was a few years ago. And they did a lot of public outreach. And they basically found that the vast majority, I want to say something like 80%, of people want separated bike lanes, proper, safe bike infrastructure, and that they feel that they would bike more if they had that. And yet, if you look at the bicycle master plan that the city put out, that really doesn't reflect the kind of public opinion that they spent all this time trying to figure out. And so, even though we have a lot of people saying we want action on this, somehow our elected officials are not hearing that. And that's partially because of fossil fuel companies. So, that means that we need a lot more grassroots organizing and mobilizing to really hold the feet to the fire amongst our elected officials so that we can start to get action through things like, for example, a Green New Deal.
Thank you so much for that answer. How do you guys see, I've talked to Pello in the previously about how people in academia are a bit more free compared to their counterparts in both policymakers and organizers, and what they're allowed to kind of imagine in terms of a truly radical community, and how we can kind of bridge that gap between what we see as like a truly radically sustainable community and what type of changes we can make in policy and on the ground. Scott.
Hi, this is David Pello. Are you asking me to be radical? Is that the question? You know, I think I'm actually quite conservative.
That's because you're on a university campus.
No, I mean in the sense that I'm interested in conserving our life support systems, conserving our ability to survive. I think, you know, I mean, of course, there's two uses of the term radical. One is the correct use, getting at the root, but the other is the more common and unfortunate use, which is extremist, and so I'll use both. The extremist, you know, version of radicalism, I think, is what we have, which is irrational, which is literally insane and ecocidal and genocidal in the sense that you are going to continue business as usual, which the science is very clear, which our traditional environmental knowledge carriers are very clear about, which is thoroughly unsustainable, deeply, deeply violent, and destructive. So that's radical. It's much more sensible and conservative to say let's actually do something about this. Let's actually conserve our life support systems. But the proper use of the term radical would be to get at the root. And let's carry it back to, for example, Puerto Rico, which is a place, of course, that's been hit by a number of disasters. Very recently, of course, by Hurricane Maria, and many of the activists and who are dealing with climate and environmental and energy justice in Puerto Rico, groups like Colectivo Feminista, groups like Coqui Solar, and many others, have said, you know, in Puerto Rico, there's a saying that hurricanes are actually natural. It's disasters are political, right? And so what makes a quote-unquote natural disaster unnatural is at least two things. One is that in many cases we can actually find that the drivers of that disaster are themselves unnatural in the sense that they're socially caused, but it's usually the impact. So if we have a hurricane, we have a tornado, we have an earthquake, we have a tsunami, we have a drought, you name it, wildfires, etc., the impacts of those disasters become deeply, deeply uneven. And so going back to 1999, the leading scholars of natural disasters had said that the defining characteristics that make for greater vulnerability in unnatural disasters in the United States are gender, race and ethnicity, and socioeconomic status. And this is Dennis Mulledy, who at the time was the leading natural disasters scholar who put together this national assessment of natural disasters in the United States with a whole host, literally dozens of folks. So inequality, again, is at the core. That is the root driving force. So in Puerto Rico, you have groups that are saying, we need to denaturalize these disasters and actually politicize and repoliticize them and understand their political roots. So getting to the point about radicalism. And so one way that groups like that have been doing that has been actually going back to the problem of colonialism. The fact that in 1898, the United States literally ripped Puerto Rico, not only from the Puerto Rican people, but from another empire, from the Spanish Empire, as did the United States with Guam, with the Philippines, with numerous other parts of the world. And we call it a territory, but it's actually a colony. And so a lot of people, even liberals and lefties, will say, no, you know, Puerto Rico is part of the United States. Yes, it is. Only insofar as it is a colony. As was just stated, Puerto Ricans cannot vote. They can't even elect their own governor. That's appointed by the United States president. And then we've got, of course, the Jones Act of 1917, which actually exacerbated the recovery and the cleanup and reparations process in the wake of Hurricane Maria. This is the act that says that trade and commerce between the mainland United States and Puerto Rico can only happen on vessels that were designed, that were built in, and that have flags of the United States, therefore making it very difficult for the island, for the territory, for the colony of Puerto Rico to get deeply needed resources. The racism that runs deep between the mainland and Puerto Rico shapes those relationships through and through, not only Puerto Rico cult, Puerto Rican culture, but also getting back to the anti-blackness, the anti-indigeneity of that racism and white supremacy that has shaped thoroughly U.S.-Puerto Rican relations. Then we go into the 1930s and 1940s, and we look at Operation Bootstrap, which is in what we today would call a neoliberal economic policy that made literally four monopolies, four companies in charge of pretty much all of the industries in Puerto Rico that dominated that island, that gave those industries from the mainland the ability to do business there, to extract resources, to pollute, to exploit workers and ecosystems. With low, extremely low wages, virtually no regulations, and virtually no oversight. And so that colonial domination that we've seen going back well over a century has shaped the disaster itself, the unnaturalness of the disaster, and the ability or the lack thereof of ordinary folks from places like Guayama, not Condado, as was mentioned properly, a more wealthy neighborhood in Puerto Rico, but Guayama, which is living in the shadow of a coal-fired power plant that is producing toxic ash, poisoning people there. The water is contaminated, food shortages, electricity shortages, et cetera. It is that coloniality that runs deeply through and through in that relationship. So if I'm going to get radical, let's talk about some roots. The root of that problem is a colonial mentality and colonial policies, and we do need to decolonize that relationship.
And I would say if we're going to talk about radical solutions, I would say that we have to talk about our own participation in this environmental injustice. It is, I guess this is partially the organizer in me, is to give you something to do, but it's the reality of the situation is that that this system is so geared towards environmental racism that you're reinforcing that every week with your purchases. So am I. I mean, I try to minimize it. And that is in how much gas you buy and in where you buy products from. There's a reason why the ports are humming. The reason is because people, buy from an international market without regard to the effect of workers from those factories where those products come from. And there's an environmental consequence, too. But the most irrational thing we do every week is the gas we buy. There is no factor of environmental racism that impacts the lives, lifespan, and health of communities of color in this state more than how much people drive. And here, this county, the birthplace of environmentalism, supposedly, We are totally failing our climate change goals because we're driving more and more and more. And if only a small percentage of us were willing to cut 30% of our impact, we would shake that system to the core. It is dependent upon our collaboration, and we should stop being collaborators. We should stop collaborating with the fossil fuel industry and these corporate and structural economic policies that hurt communities of color.
This is Genevieve, really quickly. I mean, honestly, there's no ethical consumption under late capitalism, so we're just going to leave that at that. If we're talking radical, radicals paying a living wage, even if it goes to farm, like even our farm workers who are right now are making $15,000 to $20,000, pay them a living wage. And it's funny, David, that you mentioned decolonizing, because I literally wrote that in my notes. So we need to decolonize this. Again, thinking about agriculture, those are luxury crops. Strawberries are not natural to this region the way they're being produced. Let's go back to acorns. Let's go back to ways that we can decolonize our diet and start there. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you so much, everyone, for your amazing responses. We have to move on to our Q&A session, but before we do that, we're going to be ending our live broadcast of this event on KCSB 91.9 FM Santa Barbara. I'd like to quickly thank the panelists for being here and for everyone who made this event possible. Just a reminder that this event and events like this are made possible by listener support. If you enjoyed this panel, we encourage you to call in at 805-893-2424, 805-893-2424, and pledge your support.